The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're discussing the practice and the ethics of using animals in scientific research. We'll talk to Bill Berry, chief historian at NASA, about the history of animals in space exploration. Then we're joined by Janet D. Stemwedel, who writes as Dr. Freeride at the blog Adventures in Ethics and Science. Before we get to our interviews, I'd like to share a new project that I'm really excited about. Skeptic Magazine has decided to compile a 2011 sequel to their Skeptics Mixtape project, and they've asked me to be in charge of finding the music. So what I'm looking for are great songs that happen to be about things like science, evidence, investigation, curiosity, scams, or even the paranormal. So if you've got an original song that you'd like to submit, or an artist whose work you'd like to suggest, send an email to mixtape@skeptic.com and check out skepticblog.org for more information, or click the link on this week's episode post on skepticallyspeaking.com. Now, join us for an hour on the science and ethics of animal testing. Thanks for listening. I'm here with Bill Berry, NASA's chief historian since September 2010. Prior to being selected for this position, he served as the NASA European representative at the United States Embassy in Paris and at NASA headquarters as a senior international program specialist. Dr. Berry joined NASA in 2001 after retiring from a 22-year career in the United States Air Force. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Oh, thanks, Liz.
So when animals first started being used in the space program, what was the reasoning behind it?
Early on, when mostly it's post-war, post-World War II era, late 1940s, early 1950s, when animals were first started to use for high-altitude research is what it was known at the time. And suborbital rocket flights on both the Soviet side and the U.S. side, elements within each country were interested in the potential for human spaceflight in the future and the performance of advanced creatures at high altitudes and under high accelerations. And both the Soviet Union and in the United States, they were fairly active programs to test various kinds of animals on ballistic flights of missiles that were originally developed largely from the V-2 and World War II. But both sides were looking at that sort of technology and building their own versions of it to do high-altitude research of various sorts, and part of that was biological. So there were testing programs on both sides. The U.S. used mice and rats and things like that, but they quickly graduated to primate testing, largely small monkeys for the most part. On the Soviet side, interestingly enough, they used mostly dogs, maybe because they didn't have many primates available in Kazakhstan and other places where they were launching these rockets from.
Well, maybe tell us about some of the animals and their roles.
Well, for example, the first U.S. flight that we know of anyway was in June 1948, and it was on a modified V-2 that the U.S. had captured, and we launched it from a test facility in White Sands, New Mexico, and it was a rhesus monkey that was launched. And I think they were perhaps hoping to recover, but unfortunately, recovery procedures weren't all that good at that point. So Albert was killed on impact when it came back down again. And there were a couple of those flights like that in 1948-1949 period where the U.S. launched rhesus monkeys. There was a second Albert that went up a couple months later, and there were mice. The first successful one, I think, was in 1949, late 1949, December. Albert number four, another rhesus monkey, was instrumented up. They launched them, and they actually had a very successful flight and came back down to Earth, and they were able to follow up on other things. The main thing was to see what the impact of acceleration on a rocket would be on, you know, on primates, and whether they could, you know, withstand the acceleration going up and acceleration coming back down, and also what would happen in periods of reduced gravity, and whether or not the radiation in outer space might be a hazard to them, although they're up there for fairly brief periods, just a couple of minutes at a time.
Animal testing is definitely currently a controversial topic. Was it at the time?
I don't think it was at all. Interestingly enough, there were probably I would suspect that there are people who knew about it. There may have been some resistance to it. I know that, for example, when the Soviets launched a dog into orbit in 1957, Laika, who is, there was no plan to recover Laika at all because they didn't have the technology to bring a vehicle back from orbit. So they launched Laika in orbit, knowing full well that Laika wouldn't come back. Publicly, the Soviets announced that Laika would live for 2 weeks, and they had a setup there to put her down after the mission was over so she wouldn't just die of oxygen starvation. And that caused a huge amount of controversy in the West, a lot, particularly in Britain, where, of course, people were very excited about dogs and animal welfare at the time. There was a big outcry about Laika and the sacrifice that was made. So I think when it came to people's attentions, I think at least some people were critical of what was perceived as a cavalier attitude towards animal welfare at the time.
Well, how I found you was NASA's A Brief History of Animals in Space page, and we have linked to that on our website. But it mentions that after the manned lunar landing of Apollo 11, that the role of animals was limited to the status of biological payload. So what does that mean?
I'm not sure that's necessarily a big change in the status. You know, early on, of course, they were trying to determine whether or not advanced creatures of various sorts, particularly primates, could function in a microgravity environment, and whether the radiation environment in space would be deadly to them or not. And that was ascertained fairly early on that that wasn't a big problem. And for relatively short flights, and as flights got longer, that was the sort of the focus of attention. On the U.S. side, there was some sensitivity to the fact, you know, that there was testing on animals, and so I think that by the end of the 60s, there wasn't that much more to be gained by testing with animals on sort of those basic questions. And so those experiments, I think, sort of dropped off. When the shuttle began to fly again, or the shuttle started flying in 1981, of course, now we had a research facility that we could bring up lots of things with, and there were, you know, animal experiments that were conducted on those. There were generally sort of very specific scientific investigations on particular questions. For example, spiders. I know, for example, there were a number of spider experiments were sent up on Skylab, in fact, which was in the earlier 70s, but then again on the space shuttle later on. And then you know, questions about the effect of the radiation environment in space or the microgravity environment in space on various systems of animals. So various questions about biological effects of space on DNA and reproductive systems and all those sorts of questions like that. I think the U.S. interest in that was basically it was focused on the human spaceflight question, whether you can get humans and higher primates in orbit and test them, you know, and then whether the testing of the animals was designed to find out whether that would work. And then once that question was answered, there was sort of a lull. And then when we got the capability to send up larger payloads for longer periods of time, then other questions about biology and things came up. And those were the sort of the focus of work in probably the 70s and 80s and into the 90s.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Bill Berry, NASA's chief historian. We're talking about the history of animals in space. So what would the alternative to using animals have been at that point? How could research like this have been done otherwise?
Some of it could have been used, I suppose, on, I hate to say this, lower life forms. You know, that you could do some of this research on, you know, worms and
right.
things like that, bacteria. And that sort of work has been done. But a lot of it either had to be done on animals or on humans. And, of course, we had sort of a limited sample size with humans.
Right.
The advantage of bringing up a bunch of mice, for example, on the space shuttle is that you have a lot more the N you need for a scientific experiment.
And a replenishing supply, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And some of these things were things that they were testing on. You know, they were looking into questions on sort of lifespan issues, and so they wanted an animal with a shorter lifespan that you can sort of test those questions and look at next generation issues and things like that relatively quickly, which is harder to do with humans. So it takes a lot longer for us. But
right.
So, you know, realistically, in terms of the biological questions about what happens to you know, bodies in space, you know, human and otherwise, if we didn't have animals to do those tests on, they really wouldn't happen at all, other than sort of in a very long time span over human spaceflight, or accidentally. You know, you would find out later on when people were halfway to the moon or something that there was some issue that was overlooked.
Well, how about present day? How are animals integrated into missions now?
For the most part, on the U.S. side, and I'm not an expert on current research, since I'm a historian, so I know
right.
more about what happened in the past. But the in-flight research is largely, you know, limited to, you know, small animals. I know there's work going on to build a small animal enclosure to use on the International Space Station, mainly for mice. There have been fish and plants brought up. Actually, the astronauts love having plants up at the International Space Station. It's one of the few reminders of Earth, other than looking out the window. There's actually been some investigations on how astronauts spend their time, and there's allocated amounts of time for various experiments. And it always seems like the astronauts drag their feet when they're working on the plant experiments.
Are there different ethical guidelines now than there were in regards to animals?
Oh, boy. We're stepping way out of the bounds of my knowledge. I know that there's a whole part of NASA that's involved in biological research questions, and there's a whole huge thick set of guidelines on what you can and can't do, and experiments like that. Any animal experiment, actually human experiments as well, are very carefully reviewed by your medical community and the biological research community, largely to make sure that experiments will be effective, worth the effort, likely to produce results, and that they don't cause any undue harm and distress to anybody. And there are probably other criteria in there that I don't know off the top of my head here. But
the answer is yes.
The Soviets had a biological testing program that they continued. They basically used their original human space capsule, and they kept flying it. The Vostok capsule that Yuri Gagarin flew in was modified over time. They still fly a version of that, and they fly what they call bion missions, those are biological research missions. And there have been a number of cases when we've collaborated with the Soviet Union and Russia on those missions. But there have been a number of cases when we haven't collaborated with them because our people who look at those questions were not satisfied with the way the experiments were being run or they're being healthy. There's a particular case where there was a monkey test flight in the 1990s that I know of that the Russians flew this monkey test flight and they brought the monkeys back, and then there was a problem after flight, and one of the monkeys died. And our folks took a look at the procedures and methods, and we said, we're very happy to collaborate with you on a number of things, but we're not convinced that what you're doing is the best technique and method, and we really don't want to do this anymore. So we actually abstained from cooperating with them on primate testing in space for a number of years. I think we've been talking to them again about restarting that, but I don't know for sure.
How do you think the space program would have changed if there were the same ethics rules as there are now?
Well, I think it would have been much more difficult to find out a number of things. In reality, it seems to me, and I'm not an expert on biological research, but much of what was found out in the early period, in the 50s with the early suborbital flights and in the 60s with some of the orbital flights, confirmed the fact that there really aren't huge issues with the radiation environment or operating in microgravity. I mean, early on, in fact, there are people who are concerned that, for example, astronauts couldn't swallow. And they wouldn't be able to eat or drink because zero gravity would mess up your ability to swallow. And a lot of the test pilots who were involved, who were astronauts, were like, I said, you're kidding. Because we fly in zero gravity fairly frequently and fighter aircraft, we don't have any problem with being able to swallow. But okay, if you're convinced about it. So a lot of scientists, I think, wanted to eliminate various things that they were concerned about. The radiation issue is probably a bigger one than that. And whether or not the radiation environment space would be really hazardous or not. There is increased risk for being in space. You get exposed to more radiation. But they were able to determine that it wasn't at such a level that it was instantaneously deadly or had immediate effects. And there are actually limits that we now set on astronauts, how many space flights they can take and how long they can spend in space. And also, depending on what happens, if there's a major solar flare and they're exposed to more radiation than usual, that might impact the duration of their careers. There are a number of astronauts now who are basically grounded because they have been exposed to too much radiation in space, and we don't want to increase their risk of cancer and other things later in life. So those early flights, I think some people might have thought that they weren't necessarily necessary, and in fact, most of them, I think, were not particularly hazardous to the animals, as it turns out, because they came back, most of them, in good health. The bigger hazard was when the rockets exploded on launch and things like that, where we lost animals and on that or in reentry failures. But nowadays, there are biological experiments that go on animals and various missions, and there are all these rigid criteria that are very closely watched because we do all this in public, and it's a civil thing, and particularly in the United States, anyway, our people who pay taxes here want to make sure that we're not doing things with their money that they don't want us to do. So
absolutely,
we're very careful.
Thanks very much for being here, Bill.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I hope your readers will enjoy our website. If they have any questions, there's an email address on our website there. They can feel free to drop us an email, and we'll be happy to answer any questions they might have.
And they are very prompt for reference. And we'll be right back with Janet Stemweddle to talk about animal testing after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
My guest today is Janet D. Stemweddle. Janet is an associate professor of philosophy at San Jose State University. She earned PhDs in chemistry and in philosophy from Stanford. Her research, teaching, and blogging focus on the ethical practice of science and on issues in the philosophy of science. A supporter of humane, ethical animal research, she's also a vegetarian and the guardian of an adopted lab rabbit. Thanks for being here, Janet.
Thank you, Desiree.
So to start out, let's talk about the current role of animals in research. What kind of studies are they involved in?
There's all manner of research going on right now involving animals. There's work to test medical devices and drugs. The preliminary studies before one moves on to study clinical research with humans. And it's worth pointing out that at least some of the medical advances that animals contribute to benefit animals as well. They contribute to what veterinarians can draw on to treat companion animals. There's also research on behavioral type questions. And it's worth pointing out, too, that a great deal of research involving animals is field work, actually, work aimed at understanding what's going on with animals in habitats that are more and more impacted by human activity of various sorts, and you know, finding out what we need to know to actually maybe help animals in the wild.
So how does a research team decide what kind of animals to use in a test?
Well, ideally, it should be the same kind of process that scientists use whenever they're looking at a big, complicated question about the world and trying to find a good model for understanding it. It should be a question that looks at what kind of system is like the real one we're trying to understand in relevant respects, but is also simple enough that it will be experimentally tractable, that it will have fewer moving parts, if you like, so it'll be easier to understand what's going on. So sometimes what that means is you're looking, you know, if you're looking at a scientific question that has to do with genetics, it's probably advantageous to find an animal model where the animals you're using actually have much quicker generations than, say, humans do, because right. That way you answer the question quicker. Every now and then you get the feeling that animal models are chosen intentionally but not correctly. So one of the examples I became aware of recently is in testing of the safety of the chemical bisphenol A, which is often called BPA, and it's a compound that's used to make polycarbonate plastics and epoxy resins. And there's been worries about the safety of BPA because it's similar to the hormone estrogen in its structure. And so if you look at mass media reports on the research on BPA safety, the mass media usually says, oh, there's been mixed results here. So some studies indicating that it can have significant impacts on health and others not so much. But it turns out if you unmix those studies, The government studies, I believe this is the U.S. government, but I would have to go back and check, on the safety of BPA have, 90% of them have found evidence that BPA has significant health impacts. Hmm. Of the industry studies on the safety of BPA, none of them in this group found evidence that BPA had significant health impacts. And it turns out that this may have been because these industry studies used a strain of rat that was known to be insensitive to estrogen. So that's an example of choosing an animal model that shows perhaps the result that industries that profit by selling a certain kind of chemical might want to find in their research. Whereas, of course, you know, people who are committed to playing for team science and want to find out what the truth is, regardless of whether that helps the bottom line, are going to be more inclined to say, maybe we should make sure at least some of the testing we do here involves animals that, you know, don't have this special feature that might get in the way of finding a real answer to this scientific question.
Well, is it also that animals are chosen based on sort of similar internal structures to what the researchers are studying?
Often that's the case, right? So if you're studying something to do with kidneys, obviously you want an animal that has kidneys. So looking for relevant kinds of similarities. And it's not enough to say, well, we are doing research that ultimately will we hope will answer a question on human health, to say, you know, give me the animal that's closest to humans. It's which aspect of human health. For some aspects, understanding humans, we might do better looking at mice. For others, we might do better looking at rabbits. It's really the kind of thing where a good understanding of comparative physiology guides researchers in choosing what's the best model. And also there's an effort to, and I guess people, you know, sometimes worry about whether this is a sensible thing to do or not, but this is what the regulations encourage. Researchers are trying to find the best model system that's sort of the lowest on, you know, if we can answer the question with an invertebrate, the preference is to do that. If we need to go to a mammal, the preference is to use mice over monkeys. So we're sort of guided somewhat by our sense not only of anatomical and physiological similarities, but also we're noticing that the closer you get to humans in certain respects, like self-awareness, the less comfortable we are doing scientific research in those animals, unless that's really the only system that's going to help us answer the question.
And you brought up about 10 points there that we're going to continue on and okay. and discuss. But I guess before we even get into that, why can't we use computers to model these things, or cell cultures or other alternatives?
Well, there are instances where a cell culture is the right place to start in answering a question, or a computer simulation may tell us something useful. One of the problems with saying, because we have these techniques, we should just abandon animal research altogether and use these alternatives instead, is for things like computer models, the goodness of our model depends completely on our understanding of the system we're modeling.
Right.
Unless you have sort of the A to Z knowledge of how to build a perfectly working virtual mouse that will respond in all ways like a real mouse would to a brand new input, and how would you get that information except by doing a whole lot of experiments with real live mice? With tissue culture work, what we can find out is how cells, you know, growing together, usually cells of the same type, growing together in a culture, in culture medium, how they will respond to certain things. That doesn't necessarily tell us how the same drug or the same set of conditions will interact with a whole organism that has not just one kind of cell growing in a sheet, but has differentiated cells clumped together in organs.
Now, that being said, is science and are scientists actively trying to find technology and trying to model those biological processes so that at some point animal testing would stop?
scientists are looking for as many ways as they can to reduce the amount of animal testing. You know, we still want to answer. We still have loads of questions about the world we want to answer and about human health and human behavior. But animal research is kind of a pain for scientists. There's a lot of regulatory oversight. There's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of expense. And most of the scientists I know who work with animals actually care a lot about the animals they work with, too. They do not want to subject more animals to risk than is absolutely necessary to get robust scientific results. So alternatives are welcome. Usually they are cheaper. Usually they involve less time preparing a description of your protocol for a committee of people who can say, no, we don't think we're going to let you do it this way.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about animal testing. So you mentioned regulations repeatedly. First of all, are they specific to each institution, or is there an external body?
In the United States, there is a body of law that started with the Animal Welfare Act and has been subject to significant amendments that guides what is legal to do in the context of scientific research with animals. And on top of that, regulatory bodies, often the bodies that control the research funds that scientists are bringing in. And I can't think of a university at any rate that could get by without federal research funds. So The universities are pretty serious about it. So there is regulation that is applied. The mechanism by which it is applied to particular research projects in academic settings is through something called an Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, which we usually call an IACUC, because who has time to say Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee over and over again? And so those are constituted locally at each institution, and they will include a veterinarian who has some experience, you know, not only of regular veterinarian stuff, but also of the use of animals in scientific research settings. It will include at least one person who is not affiliated with the institution. So they have no stake in whether this, you know, university brings in research funding or not. And they also usually include at least one member who's the designated non-scientist on the committee, who is there specifically to represent the interests of the public. So it's not just an echo chamber full of people who say, you know, science, all good, should just go forward with as little red tape as possible. The setup is there's an actual committee of people representing different interests who look at each protocol and evaluate, is this a necessary use of animals? Is there evidence here that the researcher proposing it has taken seriously the push to reduce the number of animals to the minimal number possible to generate statistically significant results, to refine the techniques so that they're as humane as possible to the animals that are being used, and to replace animals when possible, using not only tissue culture work when that is applicable, or computer simulation if we actually have enough information that could be used to answer the question, but also perhaps using stored tissue from prior experiments, or actually searching the literature to see if the data is already out there.
How are those regulations, or I guess guidelines or regulations, I don't know what you would call them at that point, but
they are regulations, I would say, because to the extent that they need to be followed, if they're not, the funding agencies can come in and can say, no, actually, you can't do it this way, you can't spend this money. And if they find a situation that they think is falling short of compliance, they can actually shut down an animal use program. They can say, this institution, you know, animal use for science is a privilege, not a right. And so if you don't do it within the guidelines, within the regulations, you don't get to do it.
Well, how were those regulations decided on initially? Were they based on research?
It was prompted, as far as I can tell, at least, you know, putting this down in law, the Animal Welfare Act was prompted in part by some stories that really got the public's attention in the 1960s in Life magazine. So there were exposés of the horrible conditions at puppy mills. There was a story about a family tracking down their pet dog who had been stolen from their yard and turned up in research at a university lab, I believe. So there were things that were happening that were not to the public's liking. And the public, you know, being the public, got in touch with their elected officials and said, this is not good. This should not be happening. The elected officials said, yes, we agree. And they made a law. There has been a healthy dialogue since the initial Animal Welfare Act, and I think there should be, trying to balance what are our sentiments towards animals with what are the other interests we have as a society that might require that we do some additional animal research over what's been done so far. So, you know, we love animals as a society, at least enough to have an Animal Welfare Act. But we also care for members of our society who have illnesses that maybe don't have good treatments yet. And if we want to take care of those members of our society as well, maybe that's going to require some amount of animal research.
Are there different guidelines around different kinds of research?
I know more about the academic side of things.
Right.
It may be different in certain private sector research, partly because one of the peculiarities of animal welfare legislation is that purpose-bred mice, rats, and birds are excluded from the definition of animal. Which is kind of odd because, you know, you would figure they're members of the animal kingdom.
Right.
They sure look and, you know, smell like animals and act like animals. But I guess the public maybe cared more about dogs and cats and primates than they did about mice. So maybe that was sort of an initial compromise position. As a practical matter, even though, you know, at least, and I guess it's complicated too, I should pull back a little. In the United States, the regulations that come from the U.S. Department of Agriculture are slightly different, perhaps, from those attached to money from the National Institutes of Health. So what universities usually do is rather than saying, okay, the money's coming from this agency, which means we can treat mice this way. And if the money comes from the other agency, we can treat mice the other way. Usually universities err in the direction of just applying the strictest regulations across the board, because that way it's easiest to stay in compliance. In the private sector, where maybe there's more focused research, I don't know if it always goes down that way.
Are there different regulations between essential and non-essential research? And what does that mean, really?
And this is the question. It needs to be the case that the scientists putting the protocols forward to be approved are making a persuasive argument that the knowledge they're building using animals is important knowledge, that it's going to be contributing in some valuable way to our understanding. Now, how it's going to contribute and what exactly counts as an important contribution, this is the kind of thing people argue about. This is the kind of thing that when it's campaign season, politicians, you know, have a field day choosing titles of scientific studies to trot out to say, well, clearly this is your tax dollars and mine being flushed down the toilet, because who cares about honeybee behavior or, you know, something that sounds really abstract. This research on fruit flies, what
exactly
could it possibly have to do with human health? And that's what it takes the scientist, you know, the good scientist at a cocktail party who's had practice, you know, at least a good 5 minutes to explain to you how this particular piece of knowledge down the road could help you in some direct way. So I don't think there's a clear litmus test of what is necessary research and what's not. I can tell you, as someone who has sat on an IACUC for some years, that the IACUC doesn't necessarily just nod and take the scientist's word for it. Actually, especially the more animals that are being used, the higher animals that are being used, the better an argument the IACUC wants to see that this is research that needs to happen, and especially if it's invasive research.
Let's just mention the one that seems completely unnecessary at this point, which is cosmetics. So is there any way that that can still be considered essential research?
At least in the United States, the law says if you're going to put an ingredient in a cosmetic, it has to have been tested for safety. So there's plenty of ingredients right now, as far as I know. I'm not someone who compounds cosmetics, but my understanding is shampoos have been around for a long time. Probably there's a shampoo on the market that works for everyone, more or less. And if we stopped coming up with new shampoos tomorrow, I don't know that human welfare would be harmed at all, unless one's job is selling shampoos, and then there might be a hit to one's welfare, but not sort of a direct one, more of an economic one. But the other thing too is I don't know how much current testing there is on new compounds going into cosmetics. It could well be that mostly we're reshuffling the things that have already been tested. It is worth pointing out, though, for the people who are buying shampoos and, you know, cleansers, other cosmetics that say cruelty-free, not tested on animals, what you're buying is not a compound that's never been tested on animals. Often what's happening is you're either getting a cosmetic that's been compounded from things that have already been tested so they don't require new testing, or the company has paid another company to do the testing for them. So there's been some animal testing at some point. It's just a question of whose roof did it happen under.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest today is Janet D. Stemwettle, who blogs at Adventures in Ethics and Science. So continuing on with regulations, are there different research rules for different animals?
There are some kinds of animals, well, they're not defined as animals in the regulations, but biologically they're animals, that aren't regulated at all. So people who are doing research with fruit flies never have to deal with an IACUC if that's the only animal system they're using. There are other kinds of animals where there's definitely more oversight. There's definitely more of a case you need to make for the research, and better documentation, more complete documentation of the kinds of things you're doing. So it's a very different kind of thing to do research with mice than it is to do research with monkeys. The monkeys are definitely going to get closer scrutiny, and that's probably as it should be. And that's the kind of thing that institutions are going to take quite seriously as well, not only because they want to stay in good with the government that provides the research funds, but also, you know, the public is likely to get more worked up about whether primate research is necessary, whether it's being conducted humanely, whether it's contributing in an important way to our knowledge, than they will about a creature that if they found it in their garage, they'd probably go get the sticky traps.
We actually have a question on that topic from the website. It's from Cuttlefish.
Cephalopods are given what amounts to honorable vertebrate status in experiments, allegedly because their complex behavior is more akin to rats than to, say, scallops. To what extent is our policy based on how warm and fuzzy a creature is? Is behavior our proxy for consciousness? Or is behavior the actual concern and consciousness irrelevant? How do we make the decisions?
Right. And this is, I think, where we start to get into the fuzzy territory between the regulations and the gut check that the people approving the protocol have to make.
Right.
And I actually suspect that the regulations were specifically set up to make some of these judgment calls not a matter of law, but really a matter of where the sentiments of, you know, this cross-section of the public. Now, for some philosophers, actually, sentience and possibly self-awareness on top of sentience is the thing that makes the moral difference, that makes us have to take animals and their response to various things seriously. For other people, that's not necessarily where they're going to draw the moral line, but it may be a practical concern from the point of view of the scientists and their ability to conduct the work. Because scientists, you know, they're not robots. They have feelings too. So part of why we take pain and distress seriously in animals, if research is creating pain or distress, part of why those need to be minimized or managed is, you know, not just because the regulations say so, but because otherwise it's distressing to the researchers.
How does one assess pain and distress? My understanding is that procedures that cause pain and distress in humans should be assumed to cause similar pain and distress in animals.
Exactly, okay. Unless there is positive evidence to the contrary. And that's actually, yeah, part of the guidance that the IACUGs get. So how do you assess? Because non-human animals sometimes show discomfort, distress, and pain differently than humans do. So one of the things that is recommended, in addition to assuming in the absence of evidence otherwise that if a procedure could cause pain or distress in humans, it may also cause that pain or distress in other animals, you might end up looking at, can we set up a pilot study to observe how a handful of animals respond in the conditions you're proposing and to see what kinds of observable signs we can get and, you know, figure out from the literature that already exists whether they're consistent with this is an animal in distress or this is an animal who's perfectly happy going along being their animal-y self. There's clinical signs that researchers try to keep track of to see, you know, how can you tell? Is this frog properly anesthetized? Well, how does it respond when you pinch their toe? That's a real clear kind of question you can ask. And the body of literature on animal pain and distress is growing. And I think researchers, I hope, are getting better at doing literature searches that will give them relevant information when they're proposing new research to be able to say, you know, because it's research, you know, something brand new, we don't actually know exactly how it's going to play out. But given the other information that's out there, here's the best information we have, and here's what we are prepared to do as we watch what's happening with the animal to manage any pain or distress that may occur.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back to talk more about animal testing after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we look at the cutting-edge science and old-fashioned wonder of the hunt for planets circling other stars. We'll talk to Ray Jayawardena, author of Strange New Worlds, The Search for Alien Planets and Life Beyond Our Solar System. And we're joined by Seth Shostak, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute, to discuss the current progress and the uncertain future of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is Janet D. Stemwedel, Associate Professor of Philosophy at San Jose State University, who blogs at Adventures in Ethics and Science. And we're getting a bit behind on audience questions, so let's take some of those right now. This is a question from Isabel.
Recently on the Drug Monkey blog, the developers of some new educational tools that use live insects were lauded, and those expressing concern about the invertebrates were ridiculed. Can you speak to this divide? Are invertebrates just robots? Do they feel pain? And would it matter to researchers if they do?
Well, I've never been an invertebrate, so it's hard for me to speak authoritatively about what their inner states are like. I'm actually inclined to think they may have more complicated stuff going on in them than we give them credit for. Now, what that means from the point of view of what it's ethical for us to do in relation to them is an interesting kind of question. I think people draw the ethical line in different places with regard to what kind of animals are free for us to use and what kinds of animals should we use only with care and what kinds of animals should we not use at all. But I think there's another interesting line that we don't talk about as much. Why our use of animals in science seems to be a bigger ethical concern for people than our interaction with animals in other realms of our existence.
Right. I do think, though, for many people, it's easier to consider this perfectly rational utilitarian conversation when we're talking about insects or mice than when we're talking about something like primates.
Yeah, I would have been right there with you, except for the year that my kids brought home silkworms from school, actually silkworm eggs that hatched and then we fed. And boy, if they were not charismatic little inverts as they grew. I think I can say we loved them as they grew, and we were rooting for them. We were up late at night watching them try to weave their cocoons. And so different animals are charismatic, I think, partly in proportion to how closely we're actually interacting with them and whether that interaction is something that we have welcomed, that we have invited, or whether that's sort of an adversarial, please get off of my cucumbers kind of interaction.
Right. We have a question from Steve L.
How does the recent study suggesting that the bonobo neural system supports increased empathic sensitivity affect your perspective on animal research?
And we will post a link to that study on the website after the show.
I'm not familiar with that particular study, but I think, again, part of this comes down to the fuzzy judgment that we have to make as humans, deciding how much the scientific knowledge matters to us relative to the animals themselves. Sometimes for us, the gut says, if there's any other way to answer the scientific question, that's what we ought to do, because this is an animal that is getting eerily close to where we are. I think other times, though, we may make the judgment the other way. For research that's happening in primates that maybe is going to shed light on how to deal rationally with humans suffering from things like schizophrenia, I'm not sure how you look at someone suffering from schizophrenia or at their family members and say, I'm sorry, we can't get you the knowledge because look at the primate and look at how close it is to us.
And this is definitely one of those topics that understandably many people are conflicted about.
Yep.
But it's hard for me personally to wrap my head around the fact that if certain animals have been shown to have emotions and social structures and the ability to feel pain and everything that we do, is there an ethical argument that can support our continued testing on them?
I guess it depends on the extent to which we prioritize solving the problems that are affecting people who we know what they're suffering because they can tell us.
Right.
I guess that's the hard thing. Certainly, I would be the last person to say that we shouldn't care about, you know, the happiness of a rabbit or a mouse. But the extent to which our ability to reflect on our own feelings, our own physical sensations, you know, creates a whole nother level of mental stuff going on. And the extent to which we sort of look to each other and say we owe it to each other to take care of each other in a particular kind of way, that feels to me like an ethical connection we don't necessarily have to the animal kingdom generally. At least if we do, I think it's complicated. I think in the same way, actually, that we know that we have duties to our immediate family members that at least feel different in strength and if not in kind from the duties we have to people halfway around the world from us. I think there's something like that going on too. So it's not that we devalue what the animals have going on. It's that we're trying to balance it with other stuff that feels closer to us and more pertinent for us to address.
And we have another question from Len.
If someone's position is that it's speciesist to consider animals anything less than human equivalents, is it really possible to have any kind of effective public dialogue about animal testing? They're coming at it from a radically different moral starting point. There's no common ground there.
I'm not committed to the idea that just having that different moral position means that you can't have a dialogue with someone. I think once the moral position is coupled with a willingness to say, I am going to do bad things to people who have different moral positions than me, then maybe dialogue is not on the table so much. But it's worth noting for people who are concerned about what's happening to animals in scientific contexts, that the state of regulations reflects an animal welfare position. It actually does not give scientists free hand to do whatever they want to in the name of knowledge building. Because as a society, we value animals and we think animal suffering is something that ought to be minimized. Here are the limits. So it probably doesn't make the person who's committed to thoroughgoing animal rights happy, but neither does it make the person who holds the position that animals are completely different from us ethically happy.
Now, we're having this lovely, polite discussion, and that's perfect, but there are people who are not having that conversation. They are sending death threats.
That's correct.
And there's people getting those. Facilities.
Yep. Yeah.
So have you experienced anything like that?
I have briefly been the subject of mostly an internet. It was an encouragement, I think, for people to send angry email or make angry phone calls to me because I was going to be part of a dialogue about the scientific and ethical aspects of animal research. I have not done any animal research at all as an academic philosopher, perhaps surprisingly enough. It was for having the audacity to want to talk about ways that maybe animal research could be done ethically. But I do know people who have had their cars firebombed. I know people who have received phone calls and letters threatening themselves, their family members, with murder, with rape, with things falling just short of those, just for being involved with animal research at all. And it's pretty scary. You don't know who's following you as you walk from your office to your car. You don't know who might be following your kids to or from school. So it really does change the climate, and I think it's changing the climate in a way that's not to the public's benefit or to the animals' benefit. I think the animals probably have their welfare looked after best in an environment where scientists feel like they can comfortably share, not just with the people overseeing their research, but with the public. And then the public can engage in a robust discussion saying, okay, that's great, but you know, we don't need medical science to cure death. We'll be okay living, you know, to a lifespan of 90. We don't need to live to 120.
We have a question from Gold in Wellington, New Zealand.
One of the obvious alternatives is testing on the human animal. What are the accepted boundaries that are in place for human testing? If people are able to give consent, should there be any boundaries at all?
Probably there should be, because people sometimes consent to things on the basis of less than perfect information, and they actually consent to things that would open them up to harms that are not acceptable, even if the experiment would produce some really valuable information on the other end. our commitment to other humans in research with human subjects, and a lot of these have been shaped by historical instances where things have been really bad. So think Nazi medical experiments, think the public health services, Tuskegee syphilis experiments. These are situations we don't want to repeat. And so as a result of that, the regulations on research with human subjects draw some lines saying you cannot, under any conditions, knowingly expose your human subjects to, you know, risks like death, permanent disability, you know, harm to their personality, and all the risks that they undertake have to be balanced out by the promise of some result that's going to be equally valuable. And you have a responsibility, if you're doing research with human subjects, to have at least some good information about what kinds of risks you're exposing them to. Where we get that preliminary information about what kind of risk we think it's going to be is often from animal studies.
We have a question from Al M.
There's a debate around keeping animals in captivity in order to study their species. On one side, the argument is that keeping any animal captive for the purpose of research is detrimental. On the other, the benefit of the research for the species outweighs the restrictions the individual animals endure. But is it not the case that some animals thrive in captivity, experience less stress, and live longer, healthier lives? In the case of captive dolphins, is it not the case that they can choose to escape their pens, swimming into the open ocean, but choose captivity? If so, how are we to interpret this behavior?
I will confess to not being as familiar with the captive pens that the dolphins are in and their ability to break out of them or not as some others might be. But it does seem like there are instances where indeed the animals can have very good lives in captivity and possibly more so than they might in the wild where there's all kinds of unpredictable stuff going on, not just from humans, but from predators. So I think it's complicated would be the short answer to that. And I think recognizing the complication, saying that, yeah, some of the research with animals is invasive and probably even painful. Other kinds of research with animals, even when the animals are captive, the animals are probably having a pretty good time and maybe much better a time than they might be having out in the wild trying to find food rather than having it provided, trying to dodge from predators rather than having them kept out. And recognizing the complexities is something that we probably should do.
And I am going to give the last question to Bytor.
If we can raise animals for meat ethically, humanely, how successful are we in the equivalent for using animals for research?
I suspect that actually the purpose-bred animals raised for research are in better shape than what is happening for most of the animals in the meat industry. And partly this is because the scientists, for some reason, have gotten a lot more scrutiny from the public, maybe, than the meat industry, at least until lately. Part of it, too, is scientists have figured out that stressed out animals, unhealthy animals, don't give very reliable data. To the extent that the meat industry has gotten more humane, my understanding is part of what has driven that is the argument that humanely raising and then humanely slaughtering the animals makes them taste better. Again, as someone who hasn't eaten meat since the 80s, it's hard for me to say whether that's so or not. But maybe part of what's driving us to get humane in both of these contexts is purely pragmatic considerations.
I know there are many other questions that the audience has sent in, but we are out of time. Janet, thanks very much for coming on the show to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
You can read Janet D. Stemwettle's blog at scientopia.org/blogs/ethics and science. There is also a link to it on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, do click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever.
Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, our mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR, 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.